Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lamise Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Sabri Cifci, Michael Wietrich, and Ammar Shanaile about their book, Beyond Piety and Politics, Religion, Social Relations, and Public Preferences in the Middle East and North Africa, which was published by Indiana University Press in 2022. Sabri, Mike, and Ammar, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
So I wonder if we could go around and you could begin the interview by just telling us a bit about yourselves. Sabri, let's begin with you.
Okay, thank you. First of all, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure being here and finally catching up with my co-authors. My name is Sabri Cifci. I'm a professor of political science and Michael Suleiman Chair at Kansas State University. I like to do research on Islam and politics, as well as Turkish politics and Middle politics. I also teach the subjects. I think that's about it. Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm Michael Wietrich. I'm an associate professor of political science. I'm also the associate director of the Center for Global and International Studies at the University of Kansas. My research is, I like to study campaigns and elections from various perspectives in Turkey in particular, but other places more broadly. I look at institutions and politics in Iran, populism, religion, and gender and politics more comparatively broadly in the MENA and beyond.
And Ammar?
I'm Ammar Shamaili. I'm an assistant professor at the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. My work revolves around authoritarian politics, non-democratic politics, political behavior, and political economy at the micro level.
Well, it's wonderful to have you three on the show. And you've really sort of pooled your expertise to write a fantastic book that I'm looking forward to diving into. Do you mind if we start by just talking about how you came to write this book?
I can actually start to answer this question. So I knew Mike and Ammar separately. Three of us didn't know each other, you know, collectively at this point. And I was working on some projects about religion and politics in MENA. Then I, you know, met with Mike, who was doing similar research, particularly about Islamist political parties. And then in another occasion, in a conference, I met with Ammar, whose research was so fascinating because they were looking at religion and I believe in this case was radical organizations. So as I was kind of, you know, thinking about my own interest, I thought, why not? You know, these three guys could come together and maybe write, you know, an article. So the idea was, you know, writing an article. And then we had this morning coffee in Midwest Political Science Association meeting. And then I will let my co-authors take it from there.
So I can give you my side of it. I was on a panel at MPSA with Sabri. He was just really, really kind and really nice. And it was actually the first time I ever emailed somebody I met at a conference afterwards. And so I emailed Sabri, and this is before our lead article was published that revolved around the same topic. And I said, hey, you know, I'd be interested in collaborating with you. I have three different things that I'm looking at. And he said, after I emailed him, I'm guessing he spoke to Mike, and he said, actually, I have this project I'm working on with Mike. And then I was sort of brought into the fold on that. And that was, and from there, I remember, if I'm remembering correctly, we went to MESA, Middle East Studies Association meeting, and we presented a paper, a follow-up on our earlier work. And that's where it became clear to us that this should be a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was that we were almost forced into writing the book because we were discovering so much, right, in that kind of down the path of what we were thinking in our first article, and we realized there was more to be said, but we also realized that it couldn't be said easily in one-off articles. It really, you needed to really unpack a lot of things together, and I think as we move forward on the project, we just said it just makes so much sense that this becomes a book, and we went right to work on it.
And can I add like one thing here? And we also very quickly discovered that there is actually really great working chemistry between three of us, you know, something that's not easy to, you know, have in academia. So it was from the article, it was so clear from the beginning that this chemistry was magic, and, you know, it was moving so quickly and, you know, branching into different projects.
That's inspiring to hear. So let's see if we can sort of pick apart this really intricate argument that you have here. So the book pushes back against what you describe as a linear view of religiosity that dominates much of the literature on religion and politics in the Middle East and North Africa region. What do you mean when you refer to this linear view of religiosity?
Let me actually start, and hopefully my co-authors can also jump in, you know, to, you know, follow up. So the main idea here is that, look, religion plays an important role in shaping political preferences across the Muslim world. And there is a good deal of research that was published and is kind of in progress now. But our problem with this was that there was so much ambivalence, right? And we know we were critical of this you know, one-dimensional approaches to religion. You take a number of survey questions and you call it religiosity. Our point was that this is not really capturing the nuance, right? So we thought this was a linear progress where X is related to Y and that's it. So religion matters or does not matter. So we wanted to, you know, go beyond this simple approach. And, you know, for us, it was in one way a path toward getting over this essentialist approaches and one-dimensional approaches. We knew that there was a lot of diversity and richness when it comes to religiosity, the way that people understand it, the way that, you know, they live it, the way that they practice it. So this was the starting point to kind of being able to capture this nuance, this multidimensionality, explaining to the readers that when we say religiosity, it is really a lot of different things for different people.
Right. So it's more than just constructing an index based on how many times people are going to the mosque or how often they're reading the Quran, right? And it's really central to this book, this notion that you call religious outlooks. So you argue that it's more fruitful to orient research around this notion of religious outlooks. How do you understand that term, religious outlooks, or how do you define it?
I'm looking at Mike. I think he must be one. Yeah.
I wish I would have had our precise definition right in front of us. But the notion is really this understanding, this framework that people of faith have when they understand the world, right? The combination of their religious preferences and understandings and how those kind of as an entity also influence other things like their attitudes toward politics and economic preferences and that sort of thing. I don't.
I can help you here. I have the exact wording in front of me, which says religious outlooks refer to cognitive frameworks for understanding the role of religion in relation to social and political orders and norms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for that. So you note that the relationship between religion and individual attitudes is relational. Mm-hmm. So can you describe this interface between religious communities, the state, and religious outlooks?
I can jump in on that one. When people have attitudes and preferences, we assume, right, the assumption behind that is then if those attitudes and preferences are framed by religion, then it's also our cognitive attitudes or the substance of our beliefs that factor into our other preferences and attitudes. But one of the things that we see, and particularly in we see this also in research now outside of Muslim majority countries in America and elsewhere, that there's an understanding that our religion, particularly on these big questions, because religious divine texts tell us a lot of things. They tell us a lot of specific things, but they also leave a lot of ambiguity in terms of how does this interpret and how should this be prioritized and applied to our current life, our current context. And because of that, the way that religion influences our everyday perspectives is a lot more strongly influenced by how our association with religion, with our association with religious communities, how that plays out in our particular context. It causes this kind of interactive filtering mechanism that influences how we develop our attitudes. So, if you think about someone, a religious person in a various religious community, how that community interacts with the state says a lot about their attitudes toward political preferences. Also, when they think about, elements of politics, how that community relates to the society at large also has a big impact on this. And what sort of incentives or disincentives are out there in terms of that religious individual and his community and how that community will thrive or, move forward as a religious community. So I'll stop there and let my colleagues jump in.
I think I can very briefly just say that. So the idea is, look, we talk about religiosity. We say people pray, they read the Quran in the Muslim world, and this is how we should understand what they think about politics or economics and so on. But beyond that, as Mike was pointing to, these people are real people. They have connections to a social order. They are in constant relation with the politics, with the state. And this is how they define what their religiosity is going to be and if it's going to have an influence, what kind of influence it will have. So this relational nature in relation to the social environment and the political environment is key here. This is what I think, more than anything else, more importantly, we are bringing to the table, to the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just want to add a brief note, because I think you guys covered it pretty much. But, on this point, I think it also needs to be distinguished from sort of other measures that have been developed around fundamentalism or thinking about things in terms of fundamentalism. And so what differentiates us from those kinds of measures as well is this social quality. And so in a way, it's more about how it's less about what I think religion says I should do, and more about what I think religion says others should do, right? And so I think that's one of the core features, I think, that differentiates our measure and our way of conceptualizing this.
Thank you for that. So I think your argument is going to become even clearer as we go through the empirics, right? And your empirics begin with a case comparison of Naqshbandi communities in Turkey. Can you tell us about what you find there?
Well, yes. I think it's a very interesting case to look at, because you have these communities that essentially operate from the same substantial doctrine, right? The same understanding of how things should be ordered and their relationship with God and community. But what's different about each of these communities is their particular application of how they live and how they operate in society is different from each group. And what we see is how that society, how that association structures itself leads to individuals within those communities behaving in patterned ways toward politics, having particular patterned political attitudes that would be consistent or logical based on how that group situates itself within society. And so the interesting thing about these Naqshbandi Sufi communities in Turkey, which, you know, the Naqshbandis are a vibrant part of Islam and how it operates within Turkey. So these are, you know, not insignificant communities. But we can see that, like, not only do their attitudes toward politics differentiate from group to group at a particular period of time, the group's attitudes and their interpretations of politics also change, their attitudes and actions change over time as the state changes in its relationship to them, as they gain opportunities or lose opportunities. And so it was very helpful for us too to kind of document and pay attention to how these groups were interacting with the state and the individuals within those groups and their patterns of political preferences and activities kind of come from that.
And there is also, you know, when we look at over time, we see like these communities could be in different places, you know, vis-a-vis the state or in their, like, you know, social relations. So it was fascinating for me, you know, as we were writing this chapter, to realize that there is really layer upon layer complexity. It's not static. So this is our starting point, right? And I think the Naqshbandi communities in Turkey was the perfect case for demonstrating that.
Thank you. So you follow that by empirically deriving four categories of religious outlooks. I want to ask you to describe those for us.
I think I can do that. Before, you know, the brief description, I should say that this is building on a lot of relevant literature, right? You know, we kind of pull in different studies from the Middle East politics, the study of religion, generally the study of religion in the American context and elsewhere. So basically the idea here is that we can understand religion based on the role of religion in private and public space, how people, you know, find the role for religion in this dimension. And also we can understand religion based on people's preferences, whether they want to fit in a society or whether they would like a, you know, pluralist multicultural setting, right? So we are basically looking at a political dimension, which looks at the role of religion from a private public dimension. And we look at the social, you know, relations perspective, whether people prefer conformity versus plurality in their societies. So based on this 2x2 classification, we come up with four groups, religious individualist, social communitarian, post-Islamist, and religious communitarian. In a nutshell, religious individualists are people who are more supportive of religious pluralism and less supportive of religious influence in public sphere. We have social communitarians who are less supportive of religious pluralism in society, but they also are have strong preference for social conformity. And also we have religious communitarians. The individuals in this category are less supportive of pluralism in society, but more supportive of religious influence in the public sphere. So basically that we are looking at, and I'm going to leave the post-Islamists to my co-authors because I'm still, trying to really come up with a better, you know, explanation of this. But in a nutshell, then we are looking at whether people find a public or private role for religion, or whether they want a social conformist, you know, understanding of religion versus a pluralistic understanding. So maybe Mike and Amar can talk about the post-Islamist category here.
I think, for example, we use post-Islamist because I think the 2x2 category lends that particular sector to fit the definition that Asif Bayat gives in his discussion of post-Islamism, which is that the support for pluralism, right, other views, other perspectives, while at the same time supporting that the notion of like religion being an important part of public life at the same time. So basically having operating with both of those assumptions at the same time is kind of how we see that category.
And I'll just mention here, one of the things that's so impressive about this book is the variety of different methodological approaches that you embed in these analyses. So my understanding is that the way that you derive these religious outlooks is you're relying on survey data, and then you're using these sophisticated methods of latent class analysis and factor analysis to try to sort of summon, right, these categories from the data. So following that, you explore the cross-national distribution of religious outlooks in the Middle East and North Africa. Can you tell us about how that helps you understand the determinants of religious outlooks?
I think that goes to the essence of the argument, right? So one of our main position is that religion should be determined according to the social and institutional context. So the idea here is that if we can show these differences, showing that, based on different, contextual variables, we see variation in the way that people understand and practice religion, then we are on solid ground here. As you mentioned a minute ago, we look at a number of surveys, basically pulling questions, not only about, directly religious subjects, but also about how people, reflect this in their attitudes. Things like religious practice should be private. When a person changes his religion, he should be penalized with that. Do we agree that we should have respect for other religious beliefs in societies? So what we are trying to get at here is to understand this diversity and nuance. But then we also want to look at contextual factors, right? Things like what's the state's religion relation with religion, and how people make sense of this relation. Or we also look at, generally like the economic context, right? A number of other, contextual factors. And our latent class analysis from the cross-sectional perspective actually confirmed what we were suspecting all along, right? There is a lot of diversity, contextual differences, and a very, very nuanced ways of, religion and how it's understood in different contexts.
So then you move to thinking about sort of the influence of religious outlooks on sort of public attitudes, right? So you look at how religious outlooks connect with support for democracy. And I believe you begin there with a formal model. Is that right?
Sorry. Yes. So basically, the core idea here is to take these positions and think about what they represent. And obviously, people don't necessarily this is essentially a typology, right? At least at the theoretical level, and people don't fall very neatly within these necessarily within classes. They have probabilities within these classes. And so the way we kind of think about this is to model it out, thinking about, all right, how would somebody's preference for conformity affect their sort of behavior? And what would somebody's preference for sort of an increased sort of public representation of religion affect their behavior? And how should this map onto, what we see in terms of these latent groups or in terms of these religious outlooks. And so the core argument here is essentially that a preference for conformity should fairly systematically lead to a preference for more authoritarian regimes, or a preference for authoritarian, a more authoritarian system. Whereas a preference for public goods shouldn't, or religious public goods, or religious as presence in the public sphere, shouldn't necessarily consistently be pointing us in that direction. And one of the core reasons is that the context matters. And democratization itself can produce an increase in this kind of religious expression, or it can produce a decrease. And so we shouldn't expect people to necessarily be influenced in particular by this dimension. This is what our results point to as well. And so for a person who's a religious, the person who's a religious individualist, we shouldn't necessarily expect a highly pious person whose outlook is that, you know, my decisions are my own, and, you know, I shouldn't, you know, and other people have should have the freedom to do what they want. For religion to necessarily produce negative sentiment towards democracy. And in fact, we should see an increased level of support for democracy among this individual who's now given the freedoms associated with democracy that allow them to place themselves at that spot, at that position that they would prefer to be in. And the same should apply to some degree with our post-Islamist category. Our post-Islamist category is the category that wants to have that freedom to associate with a certain group, wants an increase in religion's public presence, but also wants to ensure that they are able to place themselves to practice religion the way that they see fit. And our results corroborate this.
Thank you. Now, you also, or I should say, after that, you sort of zoom in on two countries that recently experienced sort of massive political change, Egypt and Tunisia, to look at temporal variation in this relationship between religious outlooks and attitudes towards democracy. So what are your findings there?
So basically, and I think, you know, this was a very interesting chapter to write, because we, you know, when we were talking about this project, the discussion of Arab Spring in academia was still at its peak, but there was still so much confusion, right? And we knew that religion mattered there, but, you know, there was no systematic, unfortunately, up to that point, you know, account of it. We are seeing better accounts now, obviously. But the main goal of this chapter was to show that if we are right in proposing that religious outlooks are influenced by the context, by social and political change, then what case other than the Tunisia in Egypt where we can see this change happening, and whether this is affecting the religious outlooks or not? And so this was the main, main goal, and we actually found a lot of support here using the Arab Barometer surveys and using our fourfold categorization of religious outlooks. We found that indeed it is the case that context and time matter, that, you know, these outlooks are not static, but they evolve, and people, you know, change their sort of position vis-a-vis the state and the social relations as the change is happening on the ground. We also find that if we are to understand the role of religion in broader political preferences, we have to look at, you know, the change in the ground, as in, you know, significant change has happened in Tunisia and Egypt. In effect, I think looking at Tunisia and Egypt as the cases of change and temporal variability in religious outlooks showed us that religiosity is indeed contextual and relational. Right? Because, you know, looking at some of this, you know, analysis that we presented here, we see that before, during, and after the Arab Spring, we see significant differences in the religious outlooks and their distribution in both societies. So it was really great to see this, you know, as a scholar, you know, theorize about these issues and, you know, running the analysis. Seeing this was so exciting. for me. And basically, you know, Mike and I went back and forth, you know, writing this chapter. Maybe he can also share some of this this insights about how we, you know, come to a conclusion after so much analysis.
Yeah, it's a very interesting chapter, you know, and I think you're always trapped a little bit by the data that you have. It's nice that we had what we did, but, you know, and to some extent, too, like what we're arguing really is that attitudes change, right? That should be obvious, like who's going to really challenge that? But often the way that we get, you know, when we think about public opinion, particularly in areas where it's kind of hard to get those surveys done, you get locked into these snapshots of people's attitudes and you just kind of assume that's the way it is. But I think that chapter, you know, chapter 6 really points out effectively that no, things can change in very important ways in a short amount of time, right? As political contexts change. And so we don't need to necessarily some of this, you know, there's been a history of essentializing attitudes maybe toward countries in the Middle East and North Africa, where you just assume, okay, this is, you know, quote unquote, this is the way that people think, right? Like, and it's, things aren't going to change, but we're able to see and show in a lot of different ways that, that things can change and that they can change in really important and, you know, predictable ways.
And I also want to share like a fun memory. I'm probably going to get to that in the end, but I cannot resist. So in the process of, you know, changing the analysis, looking back and forth, I mean, we were very like, you know, careful, right, to make sure that we are using the right questions, we are doing all the tests and things like that. So I think a couple times, right, you know, we changed this analysis a couple times because we were like, we were not sure about the questions, about the classifications, you know. So it was basically like, you know, many, many different, let's say, approaches here between the three of us. And at some point, you know, and Mike has a really very careful, you know, eye here. It was like, oh, you are missing that point, right? So this probably should be under the religious individualist, not social communitarian. And in one occasion, I have a note. I was looking at the files this morning. I have a note on one of my Excel files saying, Mike is not going to ask me to change this again. He promised. So, but I mean, it is kind of really, you know, tells you, you know, how much, you know, effort work went into that. And, you know, we back and forth, we kind of always try to find, you know, the best methodological approach to make sure that, you know, our results are reliable.
That's really illuminating about sort of the internal dynamics of your relationship as co-authors. So moving to your final empirical chapter, there you move away from looking at attitudes towards democracy. Here you're interested in attitudes towards state-led economic redistribution and the relationship between religious outlooks and attitudes towards state-led economic redistribution. Can I ask you to briefly go over those results?
Yeah, so, you know, we felt like one of the core topics that, you know, in that, you know, in this literature on religion revolves around economic redistribution and some of the patterns that we see in the West. So we thought we definitely have to explore that to some degree. And, you know, one of the things that I, you know, that when we're going through this process, that I kept thinking to myself is, should these religious outlooks really influence, you know, attitudes toward redistribution? And so to some degree, you know, I would say it's very context driven. Now, in our chapter 5, the democracy chapter, there are very clear expectations. Our communitarian classes should be, you know, more likely be authoritarian or support authoritarian regimes or less supportive of democracy. In this case, I didn't think that was necessarily going to be the case. And when we ran the analysis, full disclosure here, a lot of this is somewhat inductive, right? We're not saying, okay, here are our hypotheses and here we're testing them very clearly. really saying, let's explore what this kind of looks like and what we might expect. And what we see is that the communitarian classes tend to map on, tend to have a slight preference for maintaining the status quo rather than any kind of radical change. Whereas our religious individualists and post-Islamists have a greater tendency to support either much higher levels of redistribution or much lower levels of redistribution. And so that's our sort of first, the first set of analyses within that chapter. And that's the, I would say the main takeaway is that these outlooks don't really map onto specific attitudes necessarily, but that there is a tendency for the communitarian classes to prefer maintaining the status quo. And one of the reasons that we shouldn't necessarily expect a particular attitude is that context is going to affect this in pretty important ways. And then we do a comparative case study at the end where we kind of do have clear expectations regarding these attitudes. When we compare Tunisia and Egypt, and the underlying argument here is essentially that where, you do have a history of religious groups playing an important role in terms of social service provision, it's going to shape people's expectations with regards to who's going to provide these kind of mechanisms for redistribution. And that should affect whether or not people think the state should be that primary cause. Now, there's a sort of deeper logic, and there's actually a formal model here that we took away that was in an appendix, and we kind of said, all right, let's save this for later and maybe do some work on it related to this. But the core idea being that, when your expectation is for the state to provide these kinds of things, the post-Islam, and there isn't really a robust, social service provision mechanism for religious groups. Here, your expectation should be that the state's provision of these benefits are beneficial for your groups, because essentially it allows people to sort of it may encourage. And I don't want to say this in a way that isn't sensitive, but it may encourage people to go and join religious groups and free them up to do that. Whereas when religious groups are participating in social service provision, here the state becomes a competitor with them in terms of that social service provision. And so I would say that those are the main points of that chapter.
I think the nice part about that chapter, I really like the way that it's shaped up in the end, because it really emphasized a number of things that we've been saying throughout the whole book, right? The context is really, really important, and attitudes are important, but they're affected in patterned ways, and that it's affected by the relationship, the contextual relationship that they're in. And I think chapter 7 maybe showed that as well as any of our chapters, this dynamic of the relational influence of religion, on the attitudes and the preferences.
So can I ask you to maybe take a step back and think about what the implications are of this book?
There are, I think, a couple, right? First of all, and I can say that we are very proud that we show the academic world that, things that we assume, but without necessarily providing evidence and testing are correct. Some of those things are correct. So basically what we are saying is that what we say should be understood as beyond the statement of obvious, but hopefully open a path where scholars are more careful in dissecting such concepts as religiosity or Islamism and understand the richness behind these concepts, right? So this is one of the implications. We also believe that one message that the book is giving is that Islam can mean many different things. There is this huge plurality and diversity to it. And one way we can understand this is looking at how different religious outlooks are being formed and how they affect people's attitudes. This is important because we have policy, in the Western context that, is based on this monolithic, one-sided understanding of Islam and religiosity in the Muslim world. So one implication is that, hey, policymakers, look, pay attention. There is really, you know, huge diversity. You should pay attention to the context. And this way you can have more informed policy in place. So maybe Mike and Amar have something to add other than this.
You said it very well, Sabri. I think for me too, like, we're really trying to kick open the door on the discussion of, like, we need to do a better job of measuring this and being more open. I think the worst thing that could happen is that then people begin to assume that there's only four outlooks, or that, you know, like, this becomes the rigid thing that then everything is measured. I think our purpose for our four outlooks was to try to come up with a logical pattern, a pattern that we could argue exists, you know, in theory in the literature, but also show, as Sabri said, the diversity among the faithful, among the religious faithful. It's not on a dichotomy. We're, you know, for most of these models, we're looking at the people that all express on surveys, you know, a moderate to high level of religiosity, and we see a very rich diversity within this group. But it's helpful to, I think what our book points out is the diversity is there, context is important, right? And there are patterns, right? We don't need to say, well, it's random. It's not completely random. Of course, every individual comes to their own, you know, positions, you know, somewhat independently, but we're all affected by our context and our situations in terms of how we take what we believe and the nature of our communities and the people that are closest to us, and how we apply that to our understandings of politics and other preferences.
Yeah, Sabri and Mike hit on a lot, so I don't think there's that much to add. One second, we can cut this out.
One second. So, and I think one thing that you haven't mentioned is that there's also value to potentially scholars of religion and politics who are interested in other regions beyond Middle East and North Africa, could potentially sort of use your conceptual or theoretical approach to think about the relationship between sort of religiosity and public attitudes.
Somebody walking in. I just wanted to note that in my opinion, there's been, and this may seem somewhat harsh, but I think there's been a lot of lazy reasoning around religion and religion's role in politics. And I think that's one of the main things that we're trying to combat, right? That's the main goal of this, is to really think about how religion shapes people's political attitudes. And we've seen some of the more recent literature has been much better about this. But, you know, I'm coming from a background where, you know, the topics that I focus on are not religion, right? That's not one of the core variables that, you know, in my research agenda. But there's something that was bothering me enough to, you know, when I wrote Sabri, say, this is one of the things I want to work on, right? And I think there are a lot of scholars who work on the Middle East and work on other regions as well, as you noted, who see that kind of reasoning and want to sort of provide a stronger explanation, and one that is more sort of theoretically rich.
I'm really glad you added that, Amar. So just looking at the clock, I'm realizing that we've taken up a lot of your time and we don't want to keep Sabri from his students. So I just want to ask you one final question, which is, what are you all working on now?
I can start. I mean, so it is, I'm actually still thinking about this, you know, plurality in religious outlooks. And I am looking into exploring it in a very unlikely context. I am looking at the role of religion in medieval Anatolian state formation. So the main, you know, project being about how different, you know, religious communities were instrumental or detrimental to the state formation in medieval Turkey.
I'll share one of my projects that I'm working on right now that I'm pretty interested in. I've been thinking about a lot. Is related to institutions, revolutionary institutions, and how they were developed in Iran. I think one of the interesting things that we're seeing in recent years is the resilience of an extremely unpopular regime, right? With if you think about the kinds of protests that happened in Iran from September till now, it's hard to imagine that a regime would have stayed on its feet after such a top to bottom social protest and such high levels of unpopularity. And so what I'm looking at now is just even thinking about those revolutionary institutions that they built that were kind of built off of Leninist assumptions, how those create this strange resilience that makes such a highly unpopular regime manage to weather all storms. And so I'm working on a project on that right now.
So I'm working on right now two different sets of projects. One is conceptualizing authoritarian regimes as ruling networks. And so I think network analysis has a lot to offer in terms of creating new measures related to authoritarian regimes that moves beyond the typologies that we currently see. A second set of projects relates to preference falsification and how we measure and conceptualize preference falsification. But I also hope that we'll return to the religious outlooks work and we'll continue with some of this because I definitely think there are some neat opportunities.
I've said too.
Hoping that you'll continue to push this research agenda forward. So those all sounds like fantastic projects that cover a lot of ground. And if any of them wind up turning into books, I hope that you'll come back and speak to our listeners about them. So thank you all. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
The book is Sabri Chifchi, Michael Wittrick, and Ammar Shanaila's Beyond Piety and Politics, Religion, Social Relations, and Public Preferences in the Middle East and North Africa, published by Indiana University Press in 2022. Thank you for listening.